The Athletic.
Welcome to another episode of the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast, a show whose name offers little ambiguity, really does tell the whole story in just a few words. We talk about football tactics, tactical trends, interesting teams, players, and tactically relevant managers with a bit of data analysis thrown in as well. And we are brought to you by The Athletic. I'm Ali Maxwell. Now, we used to be called the Zonal Marking Podcast before a rebrand this summer. That one was less literal and more deferential. Of course, Zonal Marking, the nom de plume, the pen name of The Athletic's tactics guru, Michael Cox, who's with us today. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Ali.
How are you?
I'm all right. Funny period, isn't it, for football with this weird little winter break thing. But some matches to be getting on with. WSL action, AFCON action.
And a big piece released this morning. Essentially, top flight football in Europe, love it or hate it, it's not very competitive, says Michael Cox. Talk me through that one.
Yeah, this is my big frustration with modern football is just the lack of competitiveness with the leagues. I think particularly the situation in Germany is just astonishing to have a team that's about to win the league for a 10th time in a row. I think once you get to that stage, obviously financial reform is ideal, but I have my doubts about whether that will be implemented. So I think it's perfectly reasonable to look at whether there can be kind of sporting solutions just to make the league a bit more unpredictable because... 10 in a row is, I think, a disastrous situation.
A very, very interesting piece worth a read this morning on the Athletic site. Charlie Eccleshare joins us today. He covers Tottenham Hotspur for the Athletic, also a key player in the excellent Football Clichés podcast. Hi, Charlie. Welcome.
Hi, Ali. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well, thank you. I think your second appearance on the podcast, we focused on Harry Kane and the concept of a 9.5 about 18 months ago now. It's great to have you on, as it's the transfer window and you cover a Premier League club for the Athletic. It's only right for me to start with the same question that I imagine you see every morning when you open Twitter. Any transfer news?
Adama news. It's all going to happen, but Paratici, the director of football, has this habit of kind of spinning lots of plates and as we get to the end of the transfer window, Spurs still haven't had any major incomings or outgoings, so we'll have to see over the next few days.
And certainly amongst the fan base and potentially in the dugout as well, a sense of change being needed in the short, mid, long term with this Tottenham Hotspur squad. That's really one of the things that we're talking about today. Antonio Conte and Spurs are the topic of the podcast this week. Conte, of course, one of the most impactful managers of the last decade of European football, with Juventus, with Italy, Chelsea, Inter Milan, and now Tottenham Hotspur. And most specifically for this pod, generally synonymous with a 3-5-2 formation, which has been copied at times, which has been setting trends of its own in different leagues over the last decade or so. I say generally synonymous because, funnily enough, the most recent match that Antonio Conte managed, he moved away from a 3-5-2, Michael, for the first time since, you tell me.
Since the first 5-6 games of that first season at Chelsea, before he famously switched to back three at half-time against Arsenal. Yeah, it was a big surprise. I mean, it was basically a 4-4-2 without the ball. Maybe a bit more 3-5-2-y with possession because Doherty, I thought, was coming inside quite a lot and Sessegnon overlapping. But yeah, it was very strange to see a Conte side like that, especially with, you know, the two wide players being so defensive. I mean, fullbacks, really, Doherty and Sessegnon, or wingbacks maybe, but surely not wide midfielders. So yeah, that was a big surprise. I mean, I don't know what Charlie thought of it when he saw the team sheet. It was one of those I couldn't really work out what he was doing, Charlie.
Yeah, I mean, I actually got heads up on that team a bit before, so I had time to sort of, before it came out, try and work out what it was, and I still got it wrong because I thought, just because of how wedded to the back three Conte is, I was kind of imagining that they would stick with the back three, have Davis as a left wing back and play Sessegnon as one of the front three as a kind of as a winger, just because I feel since it had been so long since Conte had played four at the back, I thought he would do everything he could to disrupt things as little as possible from a tactical point of view. But yeah, so he did go with that, but it was a hard one because you're looking at a team sheet and there was genuinely like six players we associate with being defenders. And even when I saw the way Sky were writing it, and I was at the game, obviously, and could kind of see them lining up, I did wonder if they might change it kind of as the game went on. But yeah, they did start with that back four.
And Michael, of course, it's the third time Spurs had played Chelsea in the space of, what, 3 or 4 weeks, and having lost the previous two, I guess that the question is, did Conte make this change, do you think, as, well, as a reactive change to the previous two games against Chelsea? And if so, do you think he was expecting Chelsea to be lining up with a three at the back system, which we've seen in the majority of their games under Tuchel? Of course, they went with something different as well.
Yeah, I think there's been a bit of a shift from Chelsea over the last few weeks. It felt more like a kind of hybrid system, half a back three, half a back four at times in those Carabao Cup games. So I don't think he necessarily expected Chelsea to be a back three. I think it was, you know, Conte said it was kind of for his own reasons and with the players they had selected. But yeah, very unusual to see them both use a back four. And in fact, there are only two sides at the weekend that used a back three in the same game. It was Wolves against Brentford. And I think that's the lowest in a Premier League weekend for about 4 or 5 years. But my task this afternoon is going through those figures and turn it into an article.
So are we expecting that we're seeing sort of the end of a bell curve here with three at the back formations in the Premier League, the start of which was probably Conte at Chelsea winning the title 4 years ago or so and getting to a high point where it felt like half the sides in the league had adopted that sort of system and now moving away from it, you suspect?
Maybe. You have to see whether it's a short-term trend or not. I mean, there's a couple of managers who don't seem to like using that as much. Rangnick hasn't touched it so far. I think the highest was 13. There was one weekend there 13 of the 20 teams using a back three. So certainly been a big drop-off from that.
It was quite interesting. I was talking to a player yesterday who's played in both the three at the back and the back four system. And he was saying there was a... Because Conte did it so well with Chelsea in that 16-17 season, a lot of teams copied it. But he was saying the difference when you look at Chelsea or Spurs now, or basically a manager like Conte who actually knows how to do the system, it is so, so different from teams. I mean, because I remember Wenger did it in that season, you know, which was a big departure. I mean, I think he may have done it a bit in that kind of 96, 97, his first ever season, but, you know, even hadn't done it since then. And even he was jumping on the bandwagon. But I think it is... It can work often as a kind of shock therapy thing, but to actually do it in a sustainable way is very difficult because it is so specialised. I mean, a lot of the players just, you know, have never grown up being a wing back or a outside centre back.
Coxie, it was a sad day, wasn't it, when Wenger shifted away from a flat back four for the first time in, as Charlie mentioned, like 15, 20 years or so.
Yeah, like Charlie said, I mean, they did in that first season when he took over with the season already in progress. And I think I'm right in saying that there was... The first game he wasn't even in charge for, the first thing he did was kind of barge into the dressing room at half-time when he wasn't technically in charge and moved back to a back four, which really annoyed Tony Adams.
Was that the Mönchengladbach away game?
Yeah, I think you're right, yeah. So yeah, it was 1,000 games, I think, he used with a back four until Conte came along and changed things.
And you sort of hinted at it there. Tuchel's Chelsea and their tactical system recently is interesting. They've moved away from what we got used to by the end of last season. You called it a sort of hybrid system, so I'm certainly not going to put a label on it. There's a lot of fluidity there. Talk me through what we've seen in the last few weeks with Chelsea, the basic shape and what they're trying to achieve in and out of possession.
Well, I think at times they've used a system where, you know, particularly Hudson-Odoi has been almost a winger in possession and then comes back to be a wing back without the ball. But I thought, I mean, because Chelsea dominated possession so much in this game, it did feel like, to me, it felt like the kind of system Guardiola used in his first few seasons at Manchester City with really high wingers, with Ziyech and Hudson-Odoi, and then Mount and Kovacic as like the free eights, really pushing high and forming a front five, which of course they usually do with the inside forwards coming inside and the wing backs overlapping. But now they're doing it with very high wingers and midfielders pushing forward. And of course that's a reaction to not having Chilwell and not having James. And of course their replacements not really being up to the job in the same way. So yeah, I think there's been a big change of system, but it makes sense considering the personnel they have available or don't have available.
Charlie, did it feel like that first half was about these different tactical systems, that the sort of cat and mouse tactical battle that we often see in these games, and particularly Spurs without the ball trying to get to grips with what Chelsea were doing with it?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably damning with the faintest of faint praise, but in the six halves in the three games they've played in this recent trilogy of Chelsea-Spurs matches. That first half, I thought, was probably the best Spurs looked. They felt a bit more solid. It was one of those where it felt like they were standing up to Chelsea. And Chelsea were creating chances, and they came at them really quickly. But then it calmed down a little bit, and it did feel as though that defensive system was at least going some way to frustrate Chelsea. The problem with it was that as soon as Chelsea went ahead, it's very difficult when you're set up with six defenders to then suddenly switch your whole mentality and approach. But I mean, it is really interesting. Like, the Stamford Bridge press box is right down on the pitch, and I don't think you'd want that every week, but as an occasional thing, it is really interesting just seeing it all so close. And you did get that sense, because especially in that first half, we had Tanganga was right on our side, him getting dragged around kind of all over the place by Hudson-Odoi, who is so dangerous, by the way. I mean, he really is a very, very tricky player to mark. I was kept quite a close eye on that, and I thought he actually did make a quite a big difference in being able to move Tanganga around, which then stretched the Spurs centre-backs a little bit as well.
And Michael, you wrote about the role of Mason Mount, and if Hudson-Odoi was pulling Tanganga around Mount and his runs in behind and combinations with Ziyech on the right wing, that was having the same effect on the other side.
Yeah, I thought that was the main part of the game, yeah. There was just confusion about how to deal with that front five, and it was Mount always making what I would call kind of De Bruyne-esque runs into the channel to get into crossing positions that caused so many problems. And that was really, yeah, I thought the tactical battle was all happening down that side.
And Hudson-Odoi, purposeful run. Ziyech, can he work it onto that left foot? Going for the far corner! It is a wonderful goal from Hakim Ziyech!
They were clearly fairly preoccupied with coping with Chelsea in possession. What was the plan when they won it, Charlie? Of course, it wasn't just about keeping Chelsea at bay, but I suppose with Kane and Bergwijn up front in this 4-4-2-esque formation, the idea being to hurt Chelsea in transition, were there moments where they did that?
I actually thought Bergwijn played really well certainly in the first half, in that kind of central striker role. And Conte has talked about him as, you know, being someone who can potentially play there. And I think when he said that, those of us in the room were maybe a little sceptical, because we've never really seen that for him with him at Tottenham. You know, he tends to play on either flank, but they did that quite well, actually. They played balls up to him, and when he was able to get it and turn at Thiago Silva, and Thiago Silva had to foul him and got booked, that did actually look like a vaguely profitable route for them. And then once he or Kane could get it down and spread it wide, I mean, Sessegnon had that moment, he put in the cross for which Kane then pushed either in inverted commas or not, depending on your perspective, for the goal that was disallowed. And I think that was probably the aim, was to get it to those two strikers in Kane and Bergwijn, get it out to the wide men, and then try and get both of them in the box. And yeah, I do think Bergwijn did a good job. The problem was that the supply line was so choked. I mean, Spurs midfielders were very rarely getting on the ball. And the problem with having, you know, against such a good midfield as Chelsea's is, when you've got Jorginho and Kovacic, it was just very hard for those Spurs midfielders to get a foothold and get the ball up to Kane and Bergwijn.
And Michael, the top managers in the game often making tweaks in game, and particularly halftime, crucial now in strategic terms. From your piece, it seemed like Spurs did change the way they approached things out of possession, tried to plug one gap, and in doing so, maybe caused another that led to the Ziyech goal.
Yeah, I think so. The problem was it only came 2 minutes after half-time, so it was the first real incident where you could see what they were doing defensively. But I think he was trying to drop Sessegnon back to become the wing-back, so that Davis could stay inside and stay on Mount rather than getting dragged out towards Ziyech. The problem was, of course, that Sessegnon then wasn't picking up Azpilicueta. And as soon as Azpilicueta made an overlapping run, Ziyech then just had a couple of yards to cut inside. And obviously, it's still a shot from 25 yards, and it's a brilliant shot, but I think the goal probably was likely to come down that flank. So it was interesting to see the slight rearrangement and how the goal, probably came as a result of that.
Though it's interesting because it felt that the Tanganga booking that he got in the first half for a foul on Hudson-Odoi was really important in both goals, because Hudson-Odoi turns him around halfway line and Tanganga can't foul him. And obviously that means, and Hudson-Odoi can just glide through the pitch and then spread it to Ziyech. And then for the second goal, again, Tanganga can't foul him, and then Dier has to come across and make the foul. So yeah, I mean, that was, I guess, where they won it, was on the flanks, because Hudson-Odoi won that battle with Tanganga. And then, as Michael says, I mean, Ziyech was outstanding and took his goal so well, and other moments. And yet you could see that the Azpilicueta, those forward runs, just dragging the Spurs players away and opening up the space.
Interesting to hear the tactical analysis of Michael Cox and Charlie Eccleshare from the Chelsea-Spurs game over the weekend. But next on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast, we're going to discuss Conte and Spurs and what else they've done so far in his tenure, what's worked and what hasn't.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So let's leave those Chelsea fixtures behind and talk Spurs under Conte more generally, Charlie, because you've seen this team pick up a lot of points, 6 wins and 3 draws, 21 points, of course, that in 9 games, a very strong start, you have to say, in the main. Could you sum up the sort of general tactical shape that Conte imposed upon his arrival? What have been the sort of core principles that you've seen from this Spurs team, maybe compared to Nuno's offering?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a mixture of 3-4-3 and 3-5-2. 3-4-3 has been the kind of first choice default option, which was a bit of a surprise. I think some were expecting he would go with that 3-5-2 and just try and get the most out of Kane and Son and do it that way. But actually, Moura has been really, really important. They've attacked really well as a three, and They interchange really well, and they, you know, this very much Conte's calling card, the way they attack, that one will drop deep, kind of play these 1-2s. So Kane often drops deep, receives the ball, and Moura's kind of spinning off into the space in behind. And it's funny, actually, I think in the very first game against Vitesse, there was a move like that, which was exactly that. Kane dropping deep, playing into Moura, who'd come from that kind of inside right position and scoring. And for Conte observers, it was very much we've seen this goal many, many times before. I think one of the things that's really struck me is the role of someone like Ben Davis as that left-sided centre-back in an attacking sense, as much as in the defensive sense, because he kind of, it sounds weird talking about a player who we think of as a very reliable fullback, but he's really given them an extra option in an attacking sense, because, you know, teams often are very much in their zones and it's quite regimented. And so, you know, you kind of know what a fullback's going to be doing or what a wing is going to be doing or whatever. He's in a way that we've seen from centre-backs this season, Ben White earlier in the season for Arsenal was doing this, getting the ball and driving forward. And there was a bit of like, well, who's going to be tackling him? Who's going to be stopping him? And Ben Davis, especially in those early weeks when people weren't really expecting it, would just get it. We'll kind of glide into these areas and no one would really stop him. And then they had this overload with him and Reguilon. And that was really productive for them. And then he missed a game. And I remember being like, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but Spurs are quite missing Ben Davis when they go forward, which just would have seemed like the most ridiculous thing to say even a few weeks earlier. So it's little things like that I think have made a big difference. The slight problem they've had, you know, Conte, so much of that system is about having good attacking wingbacks and fast attacking wingbacks a lot of the time. And Reguilon offers that. The problem is over on the other side is Emerson Royal, who who is a fullback. He's a fullback in the Azpilicueta kind of mold, in that you feel like he's a defender first, more than he is an attacker. But he's played as a right wing back because they don't really, I actually think he'd be better suited in this system in a way to playing as a right sided centre back, but they don't really have another option. And that's why Adama Traore became their priority signing this month, as a kind of repurposed right wing back in that Victor Moses mold. And actually, against Leicester last week, Matt Doherty came on at half time and made a massive difference, just because, you know, for all his imperfections, he is someone who will get forward a lot, cause some chaos, and they suddenly had a threat from both sides, which, you know, that I appreciate that isn't a kind of novel approach to have that, but it is something that Spurs have lacked a lot of the time. And I think that will make a huge difference to making the system work. You know, if you think back to probably the high watermark for Tottenham in the Premier League era was the 16-17 season, when they got 86 points. And the first half of that season, before Danny Rose got injured, they had Rose and Walker. And I just remember seeing them playing against teams, especially at White Hart Lane, that kind of cramped pitch. And it just felt, teams just felt suffocated, like they couldn't get out. They were just pinned back. And even when Rose got injured, Davis was really good at that back then. You know, he could play in that kind of bombing forward role. Trippier and Walker were sort of interchangeable. And I think that is something Conte wants to see, is you know, having two really athletic, pacey wingbacks who can... who can pin their opponents back, and they you know, struggle to get out. And then you've got the outside centre-backs overloading as well and asking the opposition defence even more questions.
Outside centre-backs in a three-at-the-back system, Michael, is something that we've referred back to a fair few times on this podcast. I mean, most notably, probably Chris Wilder's Sheffield United, winning promotion from the Championship, and in that impressive first season in the Premier League, Chris Basham, the right-sided centre-back, probably most famous for his runs forward, a little like Charlie was describing with Davis. It feels to me, from what we've spoken about with three-at-the-back systems, the importance of your centre-backs, one or two, or ideally three of them, having one of good forward passing ability or ball carrying ability can be very, very important if you're to be able to build up play, create chances against a low block. And that's where someone like Davies has quite an important part playing in this back three.
Conte did it with Azpilicueta a little bit at Chelsea, where almost at times he was been asked to step forward into the midfield and take up a position there. So they almost stayed with two at the back, and Azpilicueta became a third midfielder. But yeah, Davies, I think, of all the players in the Premier League, I think Davies is probably most suited to that role. I think he's not a left-sided centre-back in a four. I think he played there briefly in the loss at Palace and looked quite uncomfortable. And I don't think traditionally he hasn't had the attacking drive to play as a conventional left back, but he's somewhere in between, isn't he? And I think, yeah, when you see Spurs playing three at the back, he is, I think, very much suited to that kind of system, particularly as he's left-footed. And of course, you know, there's probably more of a need for a left-footer in a three rather than a four. In a funny way, I think if you play as a right-footed left back, I think at least you can go and stand on the touchline, and then when you receive the ball, you can move inside and play the ball with your right foot, if that makes sense. Mm. But if you're getting the ball as a left side centre-back, you're always being forced towards the flank if you're being closed down. So I think being left-footed really is important. So, yeah, he's very handy.
When Charlie mentioned the sort of formatting of the front three with Kane, Son and Moura when they were all available, I must admit, Costa, Hazard, Pedro flashed into my mind. A not dissimilar trio with a not dissimilar sort of skill set when Conte was Chelsea manager.
That is true. And they had options as well. I think Willian, in a way, could be compared maybe to Bergwijn, in the sense he was a little bit, kind of played more narrow than Pedro and maybe carried the ball in central positions as Bergwijn did, as Charlie mentioned, very well at the weekend. So yeah, Conte tends to have a bit of a template, and his systems are often very similar regardless of what team he's managing.
Charlie, what's been the best performance that we've seen from Spurs under Conte?
I kind of feel like it was the Liverpool game, the tool draw. But that was with so many players. If you remember, that was Spurs had just had the COVID outbreak. So they were missing. They kind of had a lot of players were out or were coming back. Liverpool were missing players through COVID themselves. And it was this weird, chaotic game, but it was thrilling. And so I don't know how much it's kind of a template for them to use, but they actually played that day with Dele Alli playing as the kind of attack. They played a 3-5-2 that day, and Alli kind of making runs from deep, and he did it really well. And he, you know, he could easily have scored. He was unlucky not to. Alisson made a really good save. And I do wonder if when things settle down and Conte has more of the kind of team he wants, whether they will pivot more towards that 3-5-2 with Son and Kane, and then someone like a Dele Alli, but probably not Dele Alli, making those runs. Because that was the most coherent, I think, in a way they've looked. And again, it sounds strange just because it was a bit of a mishmash team. But they carried such a threat that day. And that's also, in the league, in their league games anyway, they have had some fairly presentable fixtures, Chelsea and Liverpool being the exceptions. And obviously Chelsea, they were made to look very much second best, whereas actually against Liverpool they really took them on and were more than a match for them that day. And it was encouraging to see them do that against stronger opposition, because I think otherwise you could say, well, you know, they've beaten some teams they should beaten, some of those wins have been very, very narrow. So that's the one that stands out, and the whole occasion. And it felt very Conte like, you know, he's this kind of ball of energy on the touchline, and the team played a bit like that day, and the fans were whipped up.
Does that add a little to the sense of just a sort of sense of deflation on the weekend, that defeat to Chelsea, but maybe the fact that it didn't feel like they'd given it as much of a go, if you will, more of a mentality than anything else?
Yeah, I mean, I have some sympathy just because they were missing quite a lot of players. Like, I don't think any of the changes Conte made were because of reasons other than the fact that the guys who dropped out had picked up knocks or weren't fully fit. I don't think he went there, you know, just being like, I really want to park the bus, and I think that six defenders is the way forward here. I think his hand was forced a little bit. But yeah, of course, it's always going to be dispiriting when you see that that lineup. And I do think Chelsea, from what I've been told, there was a sense going into the game that even Conte was a little bit, even by his standards, you know, very preoccupied with Chelsea and what they were going to do, in a way that's a bit of the curse of going back to a former club, that you do, you know a lot about them and you can slightly second guess yourself. So that may have been slightly a dynamic in play as well.
Okay, well, before coming back to the Spurs squad, questions of recruitment, squad building, how Conte and Paratici might look to approach things in the short and long term. Michael, let's talk through Conte's classic 3-5-2 to see if there are any clues really as to what might come next in terms of Spurs' squad and how how Conte's dream Spurs team might look. His spell at Juventus, I'm interested in. Was he playing 3-5-2 then? I guess what I'm asking is, has Conte always been wedded to this? What is his tactical timeline?
No, when he first arrived at Juventus, there was a big fuss because he was seen as this mad manager who liked what the Italians called a 4-2-4 system. I think we would probably just call it a 4-4-2, but Italians don't really do wingers the same way that other countries do. So if there is a manager who uses proper wingers on both sides, they go a bit mad and call it a 4-2-4. But whatever you call it, it was a, you know, very different system from what he eventually settled on. I think he went to 3-5-2, one, because there were some certain tactical problems at Juventus, but also because he had Barzagli, he had Bonucci and he had Chiellini, who were three really top-class centre-backs. So, of course, he went to use that system. But that felt to me like a relatively temporary thing. Then he took charge of Italy, and of course, his three best centre-backs were Chiellini and Bonucci and Barzagli again. So he played the same system with Buffon just behind them and Pirlo just in front of him. He played the same back five, if you like, that he had for Juventus. So that became his thing. And then, you know, even when he went to Chelsea, as we mentioned before, the first six or seven games, he played a back four. He played a 4-3-3, like a fairly standard system you'd expect to see, say, Guardiola using. But then when he had a couple of problems, went back to the back three with a couple of, you know, surprise options with Azpilicueta in a central position. Well, I think the fact that he brought in Marcos Alonso probably showed that he had that in mind, because Alonso is very much a wing back rather than a full back. And then when he went to Inter, it was pure three at the back, 3-5-2. I think he tends to prefer 3-5-2 when you look through his career. The best side he's had has been the Chelsea side with a 3-4-3. But even then, in his second season, he did try and go back to the 3-5-2. I think he likes a strike partnership with two players feeding off each other and kind of third man late runs from midfield.
He has developed this reputation as being a bit of a striker whisperer. He loves he does love working with those pairs, and as recently as last season with Martinez and Lukaku. So I think that was why we did largely assume that Kane and he would just kick off with a 3-5-2 and Kane and Son. And I think that's why we slightly think that is where he will head eventually, because that has worked so well for him in the past, as Michael says.
And Michael, I feel like we've touched on all areas of the pitch so far, apart from the central midfield roles and the different central midfield combinations that he's used in his career. Is there anything that stands out about what Conte clearly wants from his central midfielders from his previous clubs?
Even when he plays a three, I think in a way there's a split between a two and a one. I think he likes a holding midfielder. He likes one of the kind of number eights to sit quite deep alongside him, and then have one who's really breaking forward. I think Barella Inter was the best example of that. But for Italy, he used a load of players in that role. Marchisio at Juventus did it quite well. Pogba at Juventus did it quite well. So I think that was, you know, Charlie mentions that Liverpool game. I think the most interesting thing from that was how well Dele Alli understood his tactical role. Like twice broke in behind to have really good chances in that, what I would call a kind of classic Conte run from midfield. Obviously, it looks like it's not really going to work out for Dele Alli at Tottenham under Conte, and he didn't actually finish those chances I mentioned. But there are, I think more than any other manager, there's certain things you just notice and you think that's really typical of a Conte side. So, yeah, those late runs from midfield, particularly to get a diagonal ball where the two strikers are occupying the two centre-backs and there's a diagonal ball and a player runs late in behind the centre-backs, that is very, very classic Conte.
Well, in the last part, we are going to analyse the current Spurs squad and try and work out who could be stars in a Conte side and who might not be such a good fit. I dare say Dele Alli's name will come up once again after the break. Right, let's finish off with a little squad analysis. With Conte's tactical fit in mind, we've heard about previous Conte sides and how he has begun life at Spurs. Charlie, let's start with the positives. Few names mentioned already. Who do you think fits perfectly into what Conte wants one of his main men to be?
Well, yeah, we've mentioned Davis, and he's probably the obvious one. I think Eric Dier as well has really enjoyed that role in the middle of the back three, where he has a little bit more protection. I mean, we saw that with David Luiz at Chelsea, under Conte. And people, I find it funny because people always say about how David Luiz is uncoachable. And it's like, well, he's clearly not, because he showed that with a really dedicated coach, he flourished in that role. And Dier is another one who, I mean, he's obviously not like David Luiz, but he has had issues playing in a two. He only started doing it regularly a few years ago, to be fair to him. You know, he was often a midfielder under Pochettino. So I think he's been learning and actually seems to really thrive in that role. And it's interesting because the assumption that many made was that Christian Romero would play that role because he played in the middle of a back three for Atalanta. I mean, he's another one. When he comes back, I think he'll be really good in the back three. But he's just played so little because of injury. So
is that as the very much as the central option, or as one of the outside?
I think Dier will stay as the central defender, and he'll play as on the right, which he did look. You know, he only did it a couple of times under Conte before he got injured, but he did look quite strong there. And then, yeah, we haven't really talked about the Spurs midfielders. I mean, I think Ollie Skip has done very well and will play whatever system Conte plays. I think he is a bit of a mainstay, and he's developed quite impressively under Conte because he's shown he can get forward and be quite effective in doing that, whereas previously he was thought to be more kind of sit deep and keep things ticking over. But I think he does have a bit more to his game.
Would that allow him to complement Højbjerg quite well?
Yeah.
Because at first I thought those two next to each other, you might be lacking a little bit of thrust. But perhaps Skip's developing that side of his game.
Yeah, and that is still the concern. But there was a game in particular against Brentford, which Spurs won 2-0 quite early on in Conte's reign. And Skip was definitely given a lot more license to get forward. And I don't know. I don't know if it's a kind of stopgap and whether he will decide, like you've just mentioned there, Ali, that actually the two of them together, they're not the best complement for one another. But, you know, while they are his sort of first choice midfield two. I think that's probably the dynamic that they'll have between them. Although Harry Winks has played well recently and he's come into the team. And actually what they did was they dropped Winks a bit deeper and played Skip and Højbjerg both a bit more advanced. And Højbjerg has played in a more advanced role for Denmark. He did that the Euros in the summer just gone. But that's, all of those players I think have done well. And Lucas Moura is another one actually who's come in probably the best form he's shown for Spurs on a consistent basis. And I think he's benefited from having quite a clear structure. And what Conte does very well, there's a lot of instruction and, you know, video analysis and all of this, and that can seem quite complicated, but his skill is giving players quite a few really important details to focus on. And I think that really benefits someone like Moura, who we've, seen sometimes not be the best when it comes to decision making.
What about Harry Kane? Feels an obvious one. The sort of player that fits into any team. How's he looked under Conte? Is he being asked to do anything different, anything new?
He's looked a lot sharper in the last few weeks. Way fitter. And, you know, and again, this is one of Conte's calling cards. And I gather that Kane has been really impressed and almost surprised by how quickly he's felt the benefits.
Just give up the ketchup.
Simple. If we think as well that Kane came off the back of Euros, a constricted pre-season, all of the will he won't he, all of that stuff, I think he just didn't look fully fit for, you know, the early part of the season. And even when Conte came, I still don't think he was at his sharpest. But that really looks like it's come back for him. And he's doing, you know, Conte has spoken before, you know, a few years ago before he took over at Spurs about how, you know, he wants someone like Kane to be in the box. I don't think we're going to see Kane go back to the kind of 16-17 era when he's getting off five shots every game and just being, you know, an absolute goal machine. I don't think he'll play that same sort of role, but he's still going to score a lot of goals. And you know, I think he's, even before the Leicester game, was averaging something like four shots a game under Conte, and then he managed about 25 against Leicester, it felt like. So that number will be quite high. So he looks like he is doing more of that. He is doing more of the getting in the box. We saw under Nuno, there were games where he was playing almost like a left winger. There was one against Chelsea, the 3-0 defeat in September, where it was weird how wide he was going. So I do think he is operating more now in areas where he can actually hurt defences. And he looks a lot sharper. He's getting on the end of things, getting in behind against Leicester. We saw that. And that just went from his game for the first few months of the season.
Michael, one of the more interesting aspects of Conte's Chelsea side was the fact that his side went from a 10th place finish the season before to a title campaign with Victor Moses playing at right wing back, a position where he'd never played before, with Cesar Azpilicueta adapting to that right sided centre back role where I don't believe he had played very much before as well. But Conte can make a lot of players if they have the right skills to play in these systems. And I wonder if there's anyone in the Spurs squad we could look at and wonder if they might be somewhat malleable. You know, could Lucas Moura do a Moses and play right wing back, or is that completely out the question? What about young Brian Gil? He's quite industrious. Could we see him at left wing back and, you know, as an attacking force in that sense?
Yeah, I did wonder about Lucas. I mean, I always used to think of him as a real classic kind of outside right, going down the outside and crossing. But for Spurs, he's actually been very good in deeper positions, more central positions. I think a lot of time he's actually been Spurs' best player this season. Not quite sure what his role is going to be. He seems to be left out of some games where I thought he might have started. I suppose the player that's going to be malleable if he comes in is Traore, who we've seen him play wing-back a little bit for Wolves. But I guess that's going to be his standard position. Brian Hill, I think, is an interesting shout. I gather he's kind of not particularly settled in London and maybe the things aren't working out. But yeah, I mean, if it's a 3-5-2, you have to think that, you know, if Hill's got a future at Spurs, then probably wing-back is the best situation for him, which I always think is just not what any winger really wants to be told. It's like your worst-case scenario. Go from being like wide in a 4-3-3 to being a wing back and having to be like fifth defender. But I'd be really interested to see Traore actually at Tottenham. I think that'd be quite exciting.
Yeah, I think it'll be good. if it goes through. But yeah, because I had the same thought about Moura and Bergwijn as to whether they could play as wingbacks, because they're both quite intelligent. They're both people who you feel often might benefit from having a bit more space rather than when you do get it as a winger and, you know, it's very constricted. But I was told that wasn't really something that they were considering. I think probably just because Conte feels he doesn't have a ton of options in the wide forward areas.
We've spoken about the players that seemingly do fit. Let's talk about a group that seem a little lost at the moment, without an obvious future in a Conte side at Spurs. I think we probably have to start with a group of midfield players, don't we? You know, you mentioned Skip, Winks, Højbjerg, as clearly being the sorts of players Conte is quite happy to use. And, you know, kind of conspicuous by their absence, players like Tongi and Ndombele, Dele Alli, Giovanni Lo Celso. You know, these are guys who are clearly different types of players that we would consider to have more of an attacking threat at their best anyway. But of course, that hasn't always come from this group of players. Charlie, can you talk me through those three and the sort of the issues that they're facing, similar or different?
Yeah, well, I mean, Ndombele, Conte has been quite clear on from quite early on. I mean, he was asked, in one of his early press conferences, was asked about Ndombele. And I think everyone was expecting, it was so early on in Conte's reign, that he would straight bat it with, well, you know, all the players have the chance to impress me, da da da. But he didn't at all. He was basically like, yeah, well, he needs to work a lot harder on, you know, giving himself up for the team and this sort of thing. It was like, that was quite a revealing answer. And that's sort of just how it's played out since. He doesn't think that Ndombele works hard enough off the ball or sacrifices enough for the team. He thinks he's an individualist. And I think, you know, like with everything with Conte, we view it through the prism of what's happened before. And so I think when Conte was appointed, it wasn't like this is the end for Ndombele, because people thought, well, look at what he did with Cesc Fabregas, who became, after a slow start, a really important part of that title-winning team. But obviously, there are big differences there. So he's been completely sidelined. Dele Alli has now been sidelined in a similar way, but I think maybe there's less. And Ndombele feels more clear cut as to why that is. Whereas Dele, as Michael says, he played really well in that Liverpool game. The decision had largely been made, though, before then, that he was going to be allowed to leave. And I always think it's an interesting one with those sorts of things, because either you're accused of being inflexible, or you could be accused of being too reactionary. If you've decided that a player isn't for you and for your system, to then have your mind completely changed by one performance might seem not the smartest. So I think, you know, we'd already reported by that point that he was available for loan. And then Lo Celso, he's another one who Conte hasn't really taken to, and he's got a bit of an attitude that, you know, has rubbed people up the wrong way before. And I don't think Conte thinks that he will give everything for the team in the way that he demands. I mean, it was telling, actually, because later on with Ndombele, after that initial comment, he was asked again about him and he dismissed it. But, you know, like, what role do you see for him in your squad? And this just before the new year, and he said he's a midfielder. And then it was kind of pushed on it. It was like, look, I'm not really going to talk about him. I'm not going to talk about individual players. And it was like, what about Harry Winks? Yeah, love him. Absolutely love the guy. He's fantastic. It's like, okay, so you are going to talk about some players. It felt quite pointed. I think it's just so important for him, the attitude and application of the players. And I do think this is partly why, as much as Paratici's just going after so many different targets might seem a bit chaotic, in a way, as long as they have the right sort of attitude, then I think Conte can probably mould them. And he's probably better than many managers who have a very specific profile of players ability-wise. I think for Conte, the main thing is this idea they'll sacrifice themselves for the team. They'll be coachable and willing to listen to his very detailed but very clear instructions.
And just to finish, quick one, it feels like, and please correct me if I'm wrong, a back three, just looking at the current squad, of perhaps Romero when he's back, Dyer and Davies might be acceptable for Conte. What about the names that aren't part of that conversation? Davinson Sanchez, Japhet Tanganga, who we've seen a bit of recently, and of course Joe Rodon as well, who I feel the need to represent a lot of Welsh football fans who are tearing their hair out at what they perceive to be quite an unfair lack of opportunities for a player who they obviously love and see as the future of the Welsh back line, but also feel like hasn't done a lot wrong necessarily when he's had opportunities in a Spurs shirt.
Yeah, it is a weird one. And he, Roden, and obviously was good for Wales at the Euros. And I think he's played well when he's, as you say, he's played well when he's come in for Tottenham. He did a bit last season. But then on the flip side, you do wonder, why is it that neither Mourinho, Nuno, nor Conte have really used him very much? You know, there must be a reason for that. But it is slightly perplexing because he's played very, very little. Whereas Davinson Sanchez, actually, we haven't mentioned up to this point. He's been really, really improved under Conte. I would put him up there, going back to the conversation of kind of players who've kind of benefited from Conte's arrival. I don't think anyone thought Davinson Sanchez was going to get a look in. And obviously a big part of that is because Romero's been injured. But even so, he's come in mainly as a right-sided centre-back and been good. You know, he's been so much maligned over the last few years, but I have actually been impressed with him. Tanganga, I think Conte likes as well. He's been linked with a loan move. I don't think that's going to happen now. And I think he'll get minutes under Conte because, again, like someone like Skip, he's very coachable, very willing to take on instruction. He just has, you know, he has made mistakes and has a bit to learn. But yeah, Roden desperately needs games, and I do hope something happens for him, you know, loan wise this month. But as it stands, there's kind of no major movement.
Charlie, just one last question while we got you and while we're kind of chatting about recruitment. I've seen a lot of anger from Tottenham fans recently about, you know, the signing of Ndombele hasn't worked out, the Celso hasn't really worked out. I've seen a few fans kind of wanting action in terms of the people who brought them into the club kind of being held accountable. But from my perspective, I mean, surely Ndombele in particular was a great signing in itself for Tottenham. I mean, he was wanted by every top club in Europe. It just seems to me like he's been managed by, you know, Pochettino, who was slightly moody towards the end of his reign. Then you had Mourinho, which didn't work out. Then you had Ryan Mason for a period. Then you had Nuno Neo Conte. Feels to me like Tottenham have got a few players who are actually perfectly good individuals. Just hasn't worked out. I'm not really sure the recruitment team should be held accountable for their failings.
Well, also in those instances, Ndombele especially was a player Pochettino desperately wanted. He basically said when he went off to pre-season, get me Ndombele by the time I'm back. And obviously, given all that had happened before, I think where Spurs hadn't made signings, I think he was sceptical as to whether that would happen, but it did. Lo Celso is another one he wanted, and they got him. I just think, and I know this for, you know, this is the view of Pochettino and the people around him. They believe, and ditto Ndombele, they believe that had they stayed and had the time to really get to work with Ndombele and Lo Celso, then they would have been successes in the way that we saw with, say, Christian Eriksen, the way he improved, or Dele Alli. You know, there were lots of Alderweireld. There were so many in that Pochettino era. Obviously, we'll never know that because Pochettino went after only a few months of signing Ndombele and Lo Celso. But you know, I do think that's a valid argument because if you think as well, they replaced Pochettino with Mourinho, kind of diametrically opposed coaches. I don't think that was easy for Ndombele. You know, maybe less so Lo Celso because he did have a spell where he was pretty in favour with Mourinho, as did Ndombele, but it took him longer. But I think they've been, in a way, collateral damage of a period of massive churn at Tottenham. And, you know, if you are going to make managerial appointments where you're lurching from one style to another, there are going to be casualties. Mm. And I think those signings were those casualties. And if you're talking about recruitment, then it's probably more the recruitment of managers there than necessarily the players that's the issue. And that's why, and I know it doesn't always work, but the theory anyway, isn't it, that's why you get in a director of football or whoever, because the overall philosophy stays the same even if you change the head coach. Whereas at Tottenham the last few years, that hasn't been the case. And that's why you see someone like Ndombele, who could have been so great under Pochettino. Many will say he wouldn't have been, but I think, you know, there was certainly the potential. Because, like you say, I was looking at this for a piece. seen the other day and reminded myself of how in demand he was at that time. I mean, really, like big clubs in Europe were after Ndombele. It was such a coup to get him. Mm. And yeah, I think he has suffered from all that change.
It's quite an interesting situation, specifically with Ndombele, Dele Alli, Lo Celso, that we've spoken about, all 25-year-old midfielders with, well, interesting skill sets, shall we say, and it'd be, but clearly out of favour. It'd be interesting to see where they all land next and what sort of level of team that is, and what they might achieve in the next 5 years or so, and whether there might end up being some regrets amongst the Spurs fan base as to how it's played out with those players. But Tottenham as a club in a really interesting spot at the moment with Conte at the helm. A strong start in terms of points picked up in the league. And of course, it will be a roller coaster ride for many reasons while he is in charge. Thank you so much to Charlie for coming on and talking us through it. Great to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
And big thank you to Michael for joining me as ever. If you head to theathletic.com/tactics, you'll get 33% off an annual subscription. And Michael's piece this morning would be a very good place to start. Very lively comments section as ever on there. We've got some interesting topics lined up for the coming weeks on the pod. We're always keen to hear any suggested topics from yourself at @AliMaxwell_ on Twitter, @Zonal_marking if you want to get in touch with Michael. Thank you for joining us this week. We really appreciate you choosing to listen to us. And make sure you do join us again next week on the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast.
The Athletic.